This is the Love Foco Show.
It started creeping in. And during the coaching calls, which was 1 hour every week, I noticed that I started kind of having some conviction about how much alcohol's a big part of my life, taking my money, my wife's having to deal with this, I'm not driving after five, and I'm being mentored. And just slowly in my heart, I knew I needed to confess to you that I drink 10 drinks a day.
Welcome to the Love Foco Show. Our podcast highlights the incredible people who make Fort Collins the place we're proud to call home. Each week, your host, Jeff Faust, sits down with local leaders, community champions, and changemakers to share their stories, what they love about our city, and how they're helping it thrive. So whether you're out on the trail, at a brewery, or walking through Old Town, thanks for tuning in.
Well, today you are in for a treat because we're sitting down with Brian Villers, the leader of Celebrate Recovery community and group and ministry, caring for those who struggle with addiction or are impacted by it. My name is Jeff. I'm your host for the Love Foco Show. So grateful for the time that Brian Villers spent with me to have a conversation about how he is impacting our community. I think many of us would agree that mental health and addiction and all the different substance abuse and really all kinds of ways that you can be addicted to different things in our society is a problem that we just oftentimes don't know what to do or how to address. Here's where Brian Villers and Celebrate Recovery comes in. Their community, their faith-based community, helping people get free and stay free, not just be sober, but actually embrace a life of recovery, is truly incredible work. I'm so grateful for their partnership with Love Foco and the way that we are going to be able to work together to care for our city. And so excited to share this conversation with you. Brian's life has had its own ups and downs, but he is on the life and the path of recovery now and is uniquely gifted to lead this community. So hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did. Well, Brian, thank you so much for being here with us and so excited to have you on the Love Foco Show. You know, our friendship and our partnership between Love Foco and Celebrate Recovery is growing and it's growing fast. And we both have big dreams about how our organizations will be able to work together, how we'll be able to love our city one life at a time. I want to talk about all the work that you're doing with Celebrate Recovery and all the lives that you're impacting. But I want to start our conversation the way we start every conversation on the Love Foco Show. Just by asking you, what is your Fort Collins origin story? Like, we all have stories about how we ended up where we're at. What's yours? How did you land in Fort Collins and what brought you here in the first place?
Well, first of all, thanks, Jeff. Thanks for having me on. And I would say it was a windy road to get to Fort Collins, but I've been here a long time. my dad was in the Air Force when I was a kid, when I was really young. So I lived in Guam and I was born in Washington State, and I lived in Chicago and Cheyenne and West Virginia and Pennsylvania and Ohio and Florida. So I lived in like...
I thought you were going to stop at like Guam and Washington, and then you just listed off like 10 more, right? Bang, 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 bang. So a military kid and the nature of that, you're moving all over the place. But there's a huge difference between Guam and Cheyenne.
Yes.
My goodness.
Well, they have the commonality is that they all have Air Force bases. So yeah. My dad was in the Air Force, and then by the time I was 10 years old, he became a regional supervisor for the Wendy's Corporation.
Okay.
And so I would move every year after that. So I moved every 2 years when he's in the military. Then I moved every year, it seemed like, when he got that job.
How many of those places like do you have memories of?
It's tough. Like, I don't remember what state I lived in when I was in fourth grade. Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know who my teacher was. I don't remember. I'd have to really kind of calculate it out because I moved so much and it was so chaotic that by the time I was 13, I'd already lived in 12 states.
Wow.
When I lived in Florida, that was when I was about 13 years old. My dad said, I'm tired of the rat race. The only time I've ever been happy was a camping trip we took to Estes Park, Colorado.
No kidding.
And so we loaded a van. It was a 1970s van with one of those little bubble mirrors on the back, you know, that stuck out on the side of the van, if you remember those. And there was a mattress in the back, and my stepdad, me and him drove to
drove to Estes Park and we froze. He did not calculate that it was going
to
be that cold.
Yeah, Florida to Estes Park.
And
yeah.
There was nowhere to live. And we lived in a cabin here or a cabin there. There was times that I was even homeless. We camped out and I would wash my hair with like water, boiling water off the camp stove. So there were some tough times. My dad was a partier and him and my stepmom were just kind of into living life and they wanted to kind of still live their party life and have kids at the same time. And so it was a weird thing, but I ended up in Estes Park in 1986 and graduated from high school there in 1990.
So how, you just said a lot there.
Yeah.
And my guess is there's, I mean, a lot of details in the midst of all of that.
Yeah.
So let me just ask you a couple of questions because I'm curious if you could fill us in, just share as much as you want, but I'm curious how you go from your dad is an Air Force guy, every 2 years you're moving, then a regional, you know, leader or director in the Wendy's Corporation, which is giant, you know, whatever that job entails, I'm not exactly sure, moving a lot. But how do you go from that level of leadership to I don't know where to live? And I think your words were, I was homeless at times. So there's got to be something that happened from Florida to Estes in the midst of all of that that landed you in that space. Like fill in some gaps there as you can.
Well, I've learned through a lot of therapy on my own and different classes and things that I've gone through to put names on certain things. And I think my dad was suffering from PTSD pretty bad. And he was in Vietnam when he was in the Air Force.
Okay.
And he was during the Vietnam War. And so he walked up and down the beaches with trained dogs and he had stories he would not tell.
Mm.
He had things he would not talk about. My friends would, later in life, he would party with me and my friends. And my friends would ask him if he'd ever killed anyone or what had happened and he wouldn't talk about it. So looking back at life, I think he was having a PTSD kind of meltdown as we went to Estes Park. But at that age, I didn't know any of that. And
sure.
So I was just living it, you know, and it was at that age actually that my dad, when he made that decision to leave the rat race and move to Estes Park, I was probably 12 or 13 years old. And he started giving me marijuana and alcohol and things at a very young age at that time. So,
yeah. Well, and this is when, you know, when you and I first met and we started talking about our life, different family situations and different backgrounds, but similar, both your life and mine in terms of the early exposure to drugs and alcohol.
Yeah.
And I mean, I this isn't about me telling my story. I'd love to hear your part of the story. But that early of exposure for me, mixed with the dysfunction that was kind of around my life at the time.
Yeah.
And I had this like weird internal drive that would get me going like crazy day after day after day, that then drugs and alcohol helped kind of me numb out from that internal drivenness that really was kind of an expression of the dysfunction I was living in. How did that early exposure impact you? And like, how did you respond to that?
You know, it kind of drew me. There's a culture in Estes Park that a lot of people don't know about. It's a high drug culture because you have the tourists that come through and then you have the people that live there year round. And the people that live there year round, there's no industry up there. They just make enough money in the summer to make it through the winter. And so you have a lot of ex-hippies and a lot of kids that their parents are really, I would call, doing free-range parenting. So like, you know, a lot of kids did that. So it kind of put me in a group at school. I, for the first time in my life, had a group and it was kind of these stoner, punk rock, metal kids, you know, that all hung out and would sneak alcohol at lunch and try to smoke cigarettes and just do all this stuff. And it was kind of our culture. So my dad exposing me to all that kind of exposed me to a whole group of kids I would hang out with at school.
Yeah. So, I'm like just trying to like recycle life. Like if we go back in time and either you're in Iowa where I grew up in, or I'm in Estes Park, we would have shared the commonality of our affinity for substances and things like that. But maybe we would have found ourselves in different circles. I think the word you said was like music and druggies and stoners. I was in the druggy stoner camp, but I was in the athletic realm where we would play sports all day. And then at night we would, you know, we would just go to Ragers or whatever. I mean, whatever it was. And it was just a... we ended our nights probably in similar way, but the context we were in was different.
I remember even little scuffles between stoners versus jocks, you know, in high school. So yeah, and I think we were all doing the same thing.
I was a jock. I mean, this probably doesn't surprise you, but yeah, I would have been on the jock side. Yeah, so
that's right.
Now fast forward, you know, 30 years from those days, 40, we're friends. We're working together to make a difference in our city. And yeah, it's funny how that all works out. You know, the things that are important to you in your 40s and 50s and beyond, they're not the same kinds of things that are important to you when you're 10, 15, 20.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Yeah. And so, you know, what happened was I ended up taking a friend's offer and ending up at a church when I was like very young. And I had an experience that kind of grew my faith there. And so as my dad was melting down, and actually I moved out at 17 years old while my dad was sleeping off a meth bench. And he called me 3 days later and said, "I saw your stuff was gone." And I said, "Yeah, I left, man." Like I had kind of a new group and a new family of friends, and I was going a new direction. And at 17 years old, I moved to Loveland, Colorado, and I started welding rebar for Colorado Precast Concrete because I had a welding certificate out of high school.
Okay. So if I'm hearing you right, you went through like some kind of emancipation type of process. Was it a formal emancipation process, or do you just like, "No, I'm packing my bags and I'm just like, I can't live like this anymore"?
Well, yeah, he was just really partying hard with some hard drugs. And I was getting into going to church and doing these different things. So our lives split apart that way. And then also, yeah, he was asleep. I had planned to move out. And I was actually kind of scared of him by that point because he was quite abusive verbally and physically at times. So okay. It was a long time before I even wanted to be alone in a room with him. I would always bring two or three friends, visit him in Estes Park.
Yep.
And he'd be like, "Why don't you just want to hang out with me alone?" But it was a fear. I didn't really want to be alone with him.
Well, and it's really hard to explain, you know. I mean, even you didn't maybe have all the words then that you do now, but you mix things like PTSD and the tail end of a really hard war experience in Vietnam. And you throw in some hard drugs on top of that. I mean, that's a pretty nasty concoction.
Yeah.
It can create a lot of turmoil.
Couple of divorces in there for him too, you know, one of them in Estes. So yeah, looking back, I've learned to have some mercy for him and understand that his life was hard. And, you know, some of the stuff he did that I've had to forgive him for, I have to look back and see, why does someone act that way? And realizing why he acted that way and what his childhood was like and what his Vietnam experience was like, it's helped me. It's helped me to heal from that.
Yeah.
Actually, so.
Well, I want to talk a lot more about your own healing journey, because you just dropped some really important things, not only for what we're trying to do in Fort Collins, but for anyone who's listening. Things like asking the second question, the deeper questions. Why was someone like this? What kind of grace can I have? What does forgiveness look like? How those things impact me? So we want to circle back to that, because I really want you to talk a little bit about your healing journey. But you had mentioned something about a church moment, a faith experience. I don't want to assume anything. I don't want to leave any kind of stone unturned there, but I would imagine your faith has impacted things like forgiveness and things like healing. So let me just go back and ask a question, because I'm curious what you mean by "I had like an experience at church." Is that like a classic, like, you know, Awana's Club, you memorize a Bible verse? Is that like a VBS type of summer camp type of, or what do you mean when you say experience at a church?
Yeah. So I didn't even know what any of those words meant. I'd never been to a church. But a friend that I was in Estes Park with would drive kids down to this church in Loveland every Wednesday to go to a youth group from Estes Park. And so we had a van.
That's a hall for a youth group, man.
Yeah. We'd pack everybody in there, even in the winter, you know, and we'd go down there. And about my second or third time there, I just had an overwhelming feeling that I wanted this for my life. Mm-hmm. I felt things probably that I'd never felt before. And I made a decision to change that. I came out of there a different person after that meeting. And he was the best man at my wedding, the guy who used to drive us down there. And I even saw him a couple months ago. And he said, "I still tell people the story of you saying, 'JD, pull the van over. And we were driving home. And I pulled all this stuff out of my pockets, and there was a pipe and bags of weed and like all this stuff. And I pulled it all out of my pocket and I threw it in the Big Thompson River on the way back up the hill. And I had made a decision that I was going to go a different way with my life. And I don't know where that came from. So I think it was divine. And I think it was a revelation.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's probably a pretty unique scene to see. I mean, I wish, you know, there are moments in our lives. I think we all have them. Moments in our lives, and we have these memories of them. But memories are funny things. You remember certain things, you don't remember other things. But I like to think we all have these memories that we could like go back to and just like watch it like a movie scene. This is one from your life that I would love to see. Because you got a van full of kids that are just driving from Estes to Loveland. You have some church experience. You're driving back up. This dude who's going to end up being your best man in your wedding, and you're screaming at him to pull over. And I mean, would he have known that your pockets were full of drugs and pipes and all kinds of stuff? Or was this like news to him?
He was surprised. Yeah,
that's awesome. They're just like almost in this act of repentance, chucking them into the Big Thompson River. And like, I like the way you said it. Like, I just want something different for my life.
Yeah.
But I mean, church and the messages cast vision and give you a hope for a different kind of future. But you were also in a really tough situation. So I imagine, like, what was it like, you know, living in a campsite or living in a cabin, being with your dad in the way, and then going down the mountain to Loveland once a week and then back. I mean, that had to have been almost like culture shock.
It was weird. And, you know, all my friends, they had like mom and dad and houses and things that I'd never really, really witnessed. And so a lot of people, I think, kind of felt bad for me. They'd give me things. I remember one year I would get like a case of Top Ramen for Christmas from people, you know, and things like that. And so just living it really poor and then seeing how families and love and all these things that I hadn't really experienced, I think that's part of what I wanted as well. And so it was all very appealing. And I'd say that that church group, which was like a youth group, wasn't little, but it was a large youth group, kind of became a family to me.
Yep.
So
yeah. It starts to fill in some of those gaps that your heart needed.
That's
knew
right.
Knew that it needed.
That's right.
Yeah. No, it's really sweet. So let's just fast forward along in the story just a little bit. So you obviously have some kind of knack for welding. You had some kind of high school certificate, it sounded like. So that age of 17, you could get hired on a crew. Take me kind of from like the 17-year-old welding Brian to when did you move to Fort Collins? Like, tell me a little bit about that journey.
Yeah, so that's good. I met my wife in that youth group. I got married to my wife, Jenny, in 1992.
Okay.
So we've been married 33 years.
Congratulations.
Yeah, and through a lot of turbulent times. And as we did that, we decided to move to Windsor. And I got really sick of welding. It was a rebar place on Highway 402 in Loveland. And the guys there were pretty mean to me. I was a new Christian, and they were all partiers. And I was 17. And so it was pretty rough. Pretty physically abusive, and I just didn't enjoy it. I started waiting tables at this Pizza Hut, and we ended up, my wife and I got married, moved to Windsor, and I became the manager of the Windsor Pizza Hut, and my wife managed this little video store. So we had free pizza, free videos all the time.
Every young adult
19 years old. Yeah, 19 years old, living in Windsor. And then I met these guys that were, one of them was one of my best friends, and they were starting a heavy metal band. And I joined the heavy metal band, and we all moved to Fort Collins. In fact, we lived on Mulberry and I-25, used stuff at mini storage. There's still a pig thing there. There were two apartments in the storage units, and we lived there. So that's the first place I lived in Fort Collins. Wow. We lived at used stuff at mini storage in these two apartments. We could practice till 2 a.m. We'd go up on the roof and yell and scream.
That's amazing.
And that's how
was
I got
Jenny
here.
Part of this crew too? I mean, like, she was like in the rock. Heavy rock scene? Or?
Yeah, if you know her, you know she's not heavy metal like looking person. And she hated it there. It was asphalt jungle. There was no grass. It was hot. She did not enjoy that part of our life. She could not wait to move out of there.
Yeah.
So we loved it. We were like, this is the greatest place ever.
Yeah.
But for a beginning marriage, it was not the greatest place ever for us to live.
And the metal scene, like, were drugs and alcohol part of that scene as well? Or was it like when you had that kind of come to Jesus moment with the Big Thompson River, did the drugs float down the river never to return? Or did you find yourself kind of back in that scene again?
So yeah, we joined this heavy metal scene, and we started selling out venues. And we started doing pretty well. We won a couple contests. We won a nationwide. We came in second in a Hard Rock Cafe nationwide contest. And we started doing really well and started packing places. And then came the alcohol and the drugs back. And I kind of told myself, you know, I could minister to these people. So I can do drugs and alcohol with them and tell them about God. And so I got this brilliant idea to leave church and do that. instead. Yeah. And, yeah. You know, it's funny when you think you're a trailblazer in certain ways, those trails are not traveled very much because they don't work. Yeah. So you go down that trail for a while, and then pretty much I was just addicted to drugs and alcohol.
Yep.
Pretty heavy, but I was highly functional. I still kept my job.
You're like in your 20s at this point, or how old are you?
That's right. Yeah. So I would have just been hitting 2021. We put out our first EP in 1992 or 1996. 1996, we put out our first EP, and that's when it was fully rolling. And we started getting some endorsements and some things going on and started doing really well.
Yeah, it's like a real band.
Yeah, we started doing really well. We worked with several Grammy Award winning producers. We ended 5 songs up in an independent film that ended up going international. And then we had investors and ended up working with like Pantera's producer and stuff like that. So the band went fairly well after that. We started touring some and stuff like that.
Okay. And all the while, I mean, was that like paying your bills, or you working at Pizza Hut during that? I mean, what's paying the bills for you? How are you eking out a living here?
So I did a lot. I ended up going back to welding. And I landed in this place that did this really high-tech welding. We joined dissimilar metals for like NASA and Lockheed Martin, and we built vacuum chambers using copper and nickel and stainless and making little tiny welds that are getting pumped down to the vacuum of space. And so I happened into this job, and I was able to do it. And so I ended up welding there for like 25 years. Wow. While I would go on tour and do things like that. And so I had a career. We had a few kids. I was high functioning, but I was still using drugs and alcohol regularly every day.
It was such an interesting story, Brian. Because, I mean, if you're like, I don't know, people probably listen to the podcast from straight from the beginning to the end. But if you're just catching in on the podcast like halfway through here, there's a ton of backstory to this, and such like an eclectic little life that you've lived, from Guam to Cheyenne and Washington, all these different states, Florida to Estes, you know, early exposure to alcohol, repenting with the Big Thompson River, striking up a heavy metal band and seeing some like quick and maybe we could say explosive growth on that in a short amount of time, to welding, but not just like rebar, but high-end metals for high-end clients in what sounds like a pretty specialized type of welding.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
I mean, that is all in, what, 30 years?
Yeah, it was pretty weird. And during that time, we experienced a tragedy that was a national story.
Hmm.
Our bass player was getting kind of weird and weirder and weirder. We ended up kicking him out of the band, but he was married to my sister-in-law. And we all lived in one house, so we just pay one rent and go on tour. And he married my sister-in-law, so she lived in the house with my wife, and it was my wife's sister. And then when we kicked him out of the band, he took a bonus to go to Iraq and be on the front lines. And when he came back, he ended up killing my sister-in-law and killing himself.
Wow.
And they left behind my 15-month-old niece, who is now my daughter. And we had to fight all the way to the Supreme Court to change the laws of Colorado to even get her. And so during the band, we had a couple nationwide stories like that were going on as well, that in a sense were raising the awareness of our band, but they were tragedies and they were really hard to live through. And so
how did you live through? I mean, because that's 60 seconds of what you just shared, but that's a lot. You're living together, which had to have been a challenge in and of itself.
Yeah.
Sisters living together with, you know, you guys married and living in the same place. Sounds like he has some kind of military background, goes to Iraq, comes back. And I mean, war is just hard on a soul.
Yeah.
And responded by taking his life. And
yeah. And I mean, we had
and others.
Los Angeles Times, New York Times. He was a Fort Carson soldier. And there were several of them that had these mental issues during that time. So it was like this nationwide story already. And then the fact that we lost my niece in our local courts because he left behind a will.
Okay.
And so the Colorado state law said the will of the parent rules. And he left her to his 60-year-old mother, who lived in a seniors-only RV park in Arizona. And she won in the Fort Collins court. But we petitioned the Supreme Court. And Ripley, my daughter, never left our house during this whole time. And so there was a lot of things that happened that were big coincidences. I would call them God moments that kept her in our house during that whole time and gave us legal standing to fight this. And the Supreme Court put a stay of execution on it immediately. And they ended up changing the law so that you also have to consider the best interest of the child along with the wishes of the parents.
Seems like a very normal kind of thing that should happen in situations like this.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it was a good change. I've had a lot of people contact me over the years.
Really?
The law is named after my daughter, and it's changed a lot of people's lives, actually.
Really? Do you know the name of the law off the top of your head?
It's called the RMS law.
Okay. R for Ripley?
Yeah, it's her initials, before I adopted her, and she took my last name.
And so how old was she when you guys adopted? I may have missed that. Did you say 15, 16 months?
So by the time that all happened, she was probably 3 years. Yeah, and a half to 3 years old.
Yeah, because those things can take a long time.
It took a long time. Yeah.
Especially when you go that high up. And
Yeah. A lot of money. Yeah.
How did you and your wife and your family, I mean, because that's, to say that that's a tragedy is probably an understatement. I mean, how did you guys navigate that amount of pain and turmoil?
Well, I don't think I did it very well. I probably drank more. And so I was a pro drinker. I drank 10 drinks a day, 25 years, probably. Wow. And I just maintained the job. I was writing things.
So when you say high functioning alcoholic, I mean, you really mean it. Because to drink 10 drinks a day for 25 years and be a specialized welder and keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah,
there's some way that not everybody is. I mean, if you've never been around addiction, you might not know that addiction has a lot of different names and a lot of different faces.
That's right.
You know, I was more of a high functioning alcoholic myself. My brother was the opposite.
Yep.
He was low functioning. Everyone knew that he was addicted. And no one would have thought that I was struggling with addiction.
Yeah.
Same family, different temperaments, different personalities responded to addiction differently. It sounded more like you're maybe on that high functioning side as well.
Yeah. And I found out there's a lot of us that are like this. I mean, I knew guys that I worked with that were engineers and designed rocket level stuff. And I would go in their office at 7 a.m. and the first thing they would do is open their filing cabinet, pull a bit of alcohol out, pour it in their coffee, and start their day. And, you know, the high functioning alcoholics are people who are like, my life is fine. I can do this and this. And I can survive. Yeah. And it's almost one of the more dangerous addictions you can have.
Well, it's like, I mean, you had mentioned earlier those you think you're a trailblazer and then you realize, oh, wait, actually, that doesn't work very well.
That's right.
Right. Like sooner or later, you meet the end of the road, your own rope, whatever it is. Turns out some of these rules, so to speak, in the human sense actually do apply to me.
Yeah. You know, as you were saying that, it's sad to say, but a lot of my heavy metal brothers that worked in liquor stores and ran bars and did all these things died from alcohol. And as you were saying that, I was imagining walking down the trail and you start seeing the dead bodies and you're like, whoa, that guy had a good job. That guy seemed like a really nice guy. And yet he died from alcohol. I mean, you know, you think about heroin, you think about all these other drugs that people overdose on, but the slowness of how you die from alcohol. And then you start seeing people die that are doing the same thing you're doing. And you go, wow. And so I went to the doctor, had blood tests done. I was pre-diabetic. I had high blood pressure to the point where my dentist wouldn't work on me because he'd come in and do my blood pressure. And he's like, your blood pressure's too high. I can't do dental work on you. Wow. And I started noticing things like that where it wasn't working. I was hiding it. I was living this life. I was even, you know, doing things with youth groups and doing ministry stuff and singing songs with church stuff. And I would just leave church and go straight to the liquor store and go home and I didn't drink 10 drinks a day as a goal. I started tracking it. It's like, wow, I started at noon and I went to bed at midnight and I drank 10 drinks. Wow. I didn't start till 7 p.m. and I went to midnight and I drank 10 drinks. No matter when I started counting.
Yeah.
So the last couple of years that I drank, I was counting and I realized it's almost dead on 10 drinks a day, no matter when I would start.
Yeah.
Stuff like that.
Which has a way, right? I mean, as we're talking about addiction, it impacts, whether people believe it or not, it impacts every area of your life.
Oh, yeah.
Now, if you're an addict and you're listening to this, you might not think it impacts every area of your life, but you're just telling yourself that story. People around you who are watching the addiction, they know it's impacting your physical health. You've already talked about that. If you're drinking 10 drinks a day, well, that's about, you know, a case of beer a day or every other day. I mean, that's a fair amount of money. It's going to impact your financial That's situations. Right. It's going to impact your relationships too. I mean, it can't not impact those relationships. And it really does begin to erode at more than just this private vice that you have, even if you think you can hide it.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I ended up, I did get a DUI once after an Avalanche game. I was at Old Chicago's in Old Town, RIP. And
little shout out there for all the listeners. Man,
it was a fun place. If you know. I backed out of my parking spot in front of Old Chicago's, and I thought I had like 4 mugs of beer, and I think they gave me a shot of Jaeger on the way out the door. And I thought that I could drive, it'd be fine. I backed out and I didn't turn I had my daytime lights on, but not my nighttime lights on. And I drove half a block and right in front of where Lucky's is now, got pulled over. The cop said, I think you're about a 0.1 by watching you and seeing what you're doing. And I said, there's no way. I was there for 3.5 hours. I had, I think I can have a beer an hour. And he informed me, no, it's your blood alcohol level, not how many beers you drank that matters to the police. And I ended up getting the DUI. So my point about that is one of the ways it affected my life is after that, I got out of it. I got a DWAI. I got a lesser charge, all this stuff. I didn't drive after 5 ever. So I wouldn't drive when I had drink. So my wife was having to take the kids everywhere. She was having, if I had drinks at lunch, I didn't, that's it. I mean, I'd throw my keys in a toilet if I had to. I would not do that again. And so it started affecting my life in all these ways where I'm putting these burdens on my loved ones that are having to cover for me. And they all know I'm drinking this much.
Yep.
But they loved me and they helped me, almost enabled me to, you know, to continue on with that.
Well, and that's one of the shadow sides of addiction, right? That's not always talked about.
Yeah.
There's addiction just has a way of impacting a family system, right? It has a way of impacting those relationships. And sometimes there's enablement happening. We don't even think it is happening. It's not like people always intend to enable an addiction, but that slow journey, that slow path, sometimes you just look up 5 or 10 years from now and you realize if you're on the other side of the addiction, wait, I might actually be empowering this addictive behavior, which I would imagine in your recovery services today, you're helping people navigate a lot of that side of the equation as well.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, I don't know if anybody's ever taken Clifton Strengths, but my number one Clifton strength is WOO, W-O-O, which is win over others.
Yeah.
And so I was very good at wording things, getting people to do things for me, finagling my way around, staying out of getting yelled at for the ways I was not showing up and the ways I should have been there. I mean, I will say in the high functioning, I still put my kids to bed every night. I still read them stories. They never knew, that I was in that deep of addiction. But,
after a while too, I mean, you're just getting used to seeing dad or brother or friend or whoever at a certain level of intoxication, that's what you think their normal disposition is.
That's right.
I mean, the family I grew up in and the people that I've been around and even myself, there are times where, the lines got pretty blurred between sobriety and intoxication because you just saw the intoxicated brother so much that you forgot kind of what it was in. So there's just always like a general sense that he was just pretty lubed up, you know, and you just don't know how much that is or how little that is depending on where he's at, but that becomes almost the new normal.
Yeah. And people start compensating for you and it just happens so slowly. Like you said, it doesn't change overnight. Now, if you're doing heroin or you're doing some extreme fentanyl or some extreme drugs where you're passing out or overdosing, then you get there quick. You get to the place where people are no longer helping you and people are no longer enabling you and you just need to get help. But when you slowly do it with alcohol and weed and a pill here or there, and every once in a while you do some mushrooms or some LSD, or, you know, when you go to a concert, you're doing some extra drugs and, you know, pretty soon you're just okaying all of it. You're excusing it all. I need this. I deserve this. I work hard. You know, you have all these excuses and you're living in denial. But when you get your blood taken, and they find 6 things wrong with you that are going to put you at an early death, that's not something you can look past.
Right. Yeah. It starts to put things in perspective in a different kind of way. Well, thanks for sharing that. It's a lot of hard things that you've been through, not only in your childhood, but also helping navigate, Ripley's life and just her own childhood and adopting her. And there's just a lot of heartbreak that you've been exposed to. And Yeah. Appreciate you sharing part of that journey with us. But I also know that I sit across from you today and you are sober and you haven't had a drink in how long now?
I'm looking at my coin here. So in April, it'll be 5 years.
5 years. So yeah. You've got your sobriety chip right here on the table. And I know that this has been a journey too. So just tell us a little bit about, how you went from drinking 10 beers a day or, you know, sometimes more than that or in a shorter period of time or whatever it is, to getting to the point where now on your keychain, you've got a 5 year sober coin and you're leading an entire recovery ministry in our city with Love Foco, at Vineyard Church, with people from all over and all kinds of different walks of life. I mean, that's an incredible journey in and of itself. So take us kind of, you know, to that point of, embracing your own sobriety journey and being where you're at today.
Well, yeah. So along with my daughter, my wife and I have three sons as well, Gavin, Eli, and Ian. And we were really struggling as a family after the tragedy, after the more use happened, after we were just spiraling, slowly spiraling down. And I knew that when I had come to church, I had found community. I had found help. I'd found people that care about me at times. But I also had found spiritual abuse and I had found kind of weird political stuff and stuff I didn't agree with. And so for me, I had left church for 20 years. And even though I loved God and believed in Jesus and studied first century stuff and got into the nerdy theology stuff, I couldn't step foot in a church.
Yep.
And as I drove—
Just too much baggage.
Yeah.
Too much weird stuff.
And I didn't want to enter that again. I felt like I got tricked. And I wasn't going to get tricked again. And so you don't know you're getting tricked until you've already been tricked sometimes. And so I was scared of that. And I drove past Vineyard of the Rockies all the time. And I always tell the story that I feel like there was a magnet dragging my car in. And as my family was spiraling and everybody was struggling, I wanted to find a faith community of people that I could be with and work out life with. And I felt drawn here to the Vineyard of the Rockies church and came in. And my wife and I sat in the back row the first time and everybody sang these beautiful songs and we just cried and we just missed this part of our lives so deeply. And so we started coming and then I started getting involved in helping out with the youth group. And then during times when there wouldn't be a youth leader, there was kind of some stuff going on where a youth leader would leave or something. I would be the interim youth leader in between things, but I still drank the 10
drinks. This is while you're drinking. Yeah. You're still a full blown high functioning alcoholic during this time.
Yeah. I'm just an alcoholic at church now. Yeah, yeah. You know, I just changed where I was, but nothing about me had changed. And I started becoming mentored by this amazing guy named Jeff Faust.
Whoa. Who's this guy?
He's an amazing dude. And that was, you know, 8-9 years ago.
We've known each other for a long time, man. Yeah. It's incredible.
I started meeting with Jeff, with you every month. And we started working on things. And sometimes we'd meet at breweries and I would drink my first beer in the time that Jeff had just taken a couple sips and I'm already up getting my second beer. And I'm like, oh boy, I'm sitting here with a pastor and I'm kind of drinking beer pretty quick. It's going to not be a huge secret here down the road what's going on. But at the same time, you know, we met for a long time.
Well, and just for the record, we also met at coffee shops and we met, you know, always, I'm only meeting with you at a brewery. I mean, we met all over the city, but yeah, I remember you taking me to some of those places, some of your favorite spots.
Yeah. I really love the microbreweries.
Yeah. And so, early in our relationship, I actually wasn't aware that you were this high functioning alcoholic. I just thought we were having a drink together and hanging out and getting to know each other.
That's right.
But and it changed over time. But,
and so I went through a few programs, leadership programs with leadership books that are like, as a leader, you're called to a higher level of responsibility. I started going to kind of an emotional healing thing called faith walking that's now called Emotionally Focused. I became a coach in that. I coached men.
We're actually hosting a Vineyard USA conference for Emotionally Focused in February.
Wow.
So I know I just dated that podcast if you're listening to that after February, but we are going to partner up with Vineyard National, host it here, because that work in Emotionally Focused, it is, I think, one of the best ways for you to grow spiritually, emotionally, relationally in kind of holistic way. And so we're excited, just a little side note, we're excited to be hosting that in the future. And it's going to be a big part of the way that we continue to disciple people.
Yeah, I mean, I went through the 9-month thing myself. Then I got became a certified coach in the emotionally focused. And then I coached three guys from Columbus. And this was a moment for me because I started coaching them and I had all these questions. You know, you coach them by sitting and asking curious questions and just kind of not solving their problems, but leading them to solve their own problems. And you're diving into stuff from your childhood and stuff that's really kind of your family of origin. And you're kind of diving into all these things. And I found it kind of hard to hear their stories. And I found myself starting to drink while I was coaching, which was a big rule of mine. I would never drink if I was going to have anything spiritual happen or if I was going to be leading anything. I'd always wait till after. And it started creeping in. And during the coaching calls, which was 1 hour every week, I noticed that I started kind of having some conviction about how much alcohol's a big part of my life, taking my money. My wife's having to deal with this. I'm not driving after 5 and I'm being mentored. And just slowly in my heart, I knew I needed to confess to you that I drank 10 drinks a day, even though I was doing ministry. And so I remember that meeting. I came up and I saw you and I just had to tell you, just so you know, I know we've been meeting for years. I drink 10 drinks every day. And I expected you to say, well, you're gonna have to go figure that out. And when you do, come back and talk to me. That's honestly what I expected. But I knew I needed to confess it. And instead, you happened to turn around and grab a box, and the box said Celebrate Recovery on the front of it. And you said, well, if you can go to some meetings, I believe in you. I believe you could be a leader. If you go to some meetings and start figuring this out, I'll let you start a small group and see if we might be able to launch this here at this church. And that's the last thing I expected. So I went to my first meeting that next week for Celebrate Recovery.
Yeah, I remember that meeting too. And actually, I remember buying that whole Celebrate Recovery kit long before. And, you know, from the moment we first met to the moment of this meeting where you kind of confessed that and we started the journey towards you started the journey towards your sobriety. And we started the journey together of implementing recovery services as part of our organization. Somewhere in between there, I can't really pinpoint when, but somewhere in between there, I knew that you were struggling with alcohol. And I don't know how to say it other than I just felt like God told me to wait until you would disclose it yourself. Because I think having grown up in a family where addiction is everywhere, having struggled with addiction myself, I lost my brother to a fight with mental health and addiction when I was in my early 30s. He was in his early 30s. I had just been around the block enough to know that sometimes you need to confront an addict, but that doesn't always go very well.
Yeah.
And we were working on plenty of other things. And we were talking about all kinds of different things theologically and just where you were at as a dad and as a husband and as a follower of Jesus, knowing that in due time, that addiction to alcohol was going to come up. And so one, I mean, I think it's really important for everyone to know that you came and confessed it. I mean, that's a really, really important part of your journey.
That's right.
The Lord was working in your heart, and finally, you just came to this place in your life where you're just like, I have to say this. I have to say it out loud. I have to say it out loud to someone who is in leadership over me that could actually take something away, theoretically.
That's right.
From me, there's a cost to that confession, and deal with it.
Yeah.
And so I'm so grateful. I have said this to you personally so many times, but I'm saying it publicly on the podcast now. I'm so grateful for the way that you kept saying yes through the whole journey of not only getting the Saran Wrap Celebrate Recovery startup kit. I had never even opened because I knew I wasn't going to be the guy to start it. But to going to the meetings, to meeting other people struggling with addiction, to committing to your STEPS program, to getting sober and staying sober, and now helping a bunch of other people on that journey as well. I am thankful for you. I know so many other people in our city are thankful for you and for saying yes all along that way as well, Brian, because it's going to make an incredible impact. I do want to just say, like, I'm curious because, you know, a lot of people have had similar church experiences to you. Where, yeah. I mean, there's some great stuff and this is the life that I want to live and these messages are inspiring or the worship is engaging or whatever it is. And also, this just got really weird and I'm leaving church and I'm not coming back.
Right.
And so many of us have had that experience. But what I always say is we never want to keep We never want to allow a bad experience to keep us from a biblical one. And so there are great churches out there. There are great communities where you can explore faith and grow as an individual, as a family, towards a relationship with God. And I would love for you to just talk a little bit about what God's been doing in the midst of your sobriety and how maybe community has played a part of that.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a huge thing. So I'm going to have to kind of focus on one or two. For me, community is everything. And leaving church the way I did, you know, I even led a lot of like atheist versus theist debates. And I did apologetics groups where you go back and you study a case for God or a case for atheism and all these different kinds of things. So I've studied these things pretty deeply, but they really don't matter if you don't have community. And I will say this too, the really good churches that are out there doing all the really good work aren't in the news very much. What's in the news is scandal and spiritual manipulation and people taking money. And that gets to the top story. Yeah. The people that are
just the pastor and the small group leaders and the regular church folks that are just doing good work. That's not making a headline.
Yeah. Somebody shows up at the Fort Collins Rescue Mission and serves everybody lunch. They're not going to get on the news. Yeah. Like, you're going to get on the news if you do something bad or something that's going to be, you know, a clickbait. And so, you know, finding out that there's just a lot of people that are living this life out and they're not in the news and they're not getting a lot of recognition, but there's a lot of people doing a lot of good things. The people helping the homeless, almost all of those are faith-based nonprofits. The people that the government or the local police lean on to help with the homeless and with unhoused and with other different things like that are mostly faith-based. And they're not really getting a lot of recognition because they're feeding people and cleaning up after them and providing these services. They're too busy doing those things to really get on the news. And so I guess I would start by saying that. And then secondly, I suppose I would say that that being part of our personal faith group and being part of our Celebrate Recovery has been life-changing. And if I miss a meeting, you know, I feel like there's something missing from my life. Like I forgot to eat or something. And so coming back, one of our biggest sayings is keep coming back. It works if you work it. And it's so true. No matter how hard you're struggling, if you show up every week, you're going to experience even micro amounts of growth if you just show up. And so showing up is really a large portion of what needs to be done.
Well, small decisions today make huge impacts and dividends in the future. But I do imagine showing up for the first time or the second time is hard.
Yeah.
Because in a way, you're admitting something when you show up. You're admitting that you don't have your crap together, that you need some help, and actually you can't do it on your own. Because, it, you know, Americans, we love to think we can just kick a habit on our own should we decide to, or if we want to, someday I'll just stop it. Well, it turns out it's called an addiction on purpose. I mean, this is incredibly difficult, physically, chemically, neurologically difficult to kick these things on your own. And so that community and those small decisions make a huge impact in the future. So let's talk about Celebrate Recovery then. Like, what, you know, we talk about, you know, how you get to Fort Collins, what you love about our city. And I always want to ask people how they're making a difference, how they're loving our city. With you, I want you to tell us about Celebrate Recovery. What is it? If people need help with it, like if they came to CR, what would they expect? And then, you know, let's save some for the end to talk about ways people can partner with what you're doing and even some of our hopes and dreams for the future and the expansion of Celebrate Recovery as Love Foco gets open and we're able to expand that partnership. So tell us a little bit about CR first and what it is that you're doing to love our city one life at a time.
That's great. I will start with the biggest lesson, and I know this will sound like abstract at first, but the biggest lesson we learn in Celebrate Recovery is, like you said, admitting that you are powerless over your addiction and that your life has become unmanageable. That's step one. And until you do that, I've seen people go through all the rest of the steps and never get that first one, really. They still think they can do it, but they have never been able to do it on their own. And when we approach the word sobriety, we talk about sobriety as being sanity. A lot of people think of sobriety as being, I don't drink anymore, or I don't use anymore. Or in Celebrate Recovery, we have people addicted to porn. We have people who are codependent. We have people who have anxiety and OCD. We have people dealing with all these things, and they're using the 12 steps to handle those things. And when we talk about sobriety and sanity,
We're not talking about stopping your habit. Sobriety and sanity for us, sanity is defined as wholeness of mind, making decisions based on truth. And that's what we call sanity. If you don't have wholeness in your mind and you're not making decisions based on the truth, then you might not be heading down a sober road, especially if you have some addiction issues or addictions in your past. And so those were big revelations for me. Am I making decisions based on the truth? And going to my first meeting, I had a bunch of lies in my head. I was not making decisions based on the truth. And I had all these excuses and reasons why I didn't need to go, almost panicky towards the end. But going to my first meeting, I sat in the back and they got done teaching and we sang a few songs. And then I was like, okay, I was in the back row. I grabbed my wife's hand. I'm ready to run out the door. And they said, okay, now it's time for share time. And I said, oh man.
Oh, they're going to make me share.
That does not sound good. That does not sound good at all. I went to the share time. And I just wanted to run out of there as fast as I could. But actually, I have found share time to be the richest and almost the secret to, there's something about confessing to some people who understand that is just so powerful, and saying it out loud, getting it out of your mind and out of your heart and into other people's ears, and then leaving it and walking away. I see people all the time walk into our share time just like I was. Oh man, I just want to leave. In fact, all the time I'm like, we're going to take a 5-minute break and go to share time. And it's like, I hope you don't leave if it's your first time. Because if you can make it to share time, all of a sudden you realize there's all these people with stories that are maybe even worse than yours. People that are struggling with things that are the same thing as you. People who tell you your story. We run into that a lot. My parents got divorced when I was 10. Oh, my parents got divorced when I was 10. You know, you see this over and over again. And then I started using, and then I started this. And you start seeing other people's stories during that share time. And then you get to share how your week went and what happened there. And it's almost, I would say, the most spiritual thing we do.
Well, I think it is. I mean, if I can just go on a quick theological riff, the beauty, and partly I know this because I've been in share groups. I've been to your Celebrate Recovery, but I also know enough about the beauty of these groups is you really are, you're sharing in a judgment-free zone where there's like rules of engagement.
That's right.
And one of them is you're not there to fix other people.
That's right.
You are there to bear witness. To bear witness to their pain, to bear witness to their story, and by bearing witness and kind of holding that moment of testifying of what they've been going through, you actually add dignity to their life. Yes. And so theologically, we talk a lot about how everyone you meet is created in the image of God. Yes. There's not a single person that you're not going to walk past that isn't created in the image of God. Now, we all struggle with different distortions, and some of us have addictions, and some of us are addicted to things that are more socially acceptable, or we have areas of brokenness that make it harder to see maybe the way that we're created in God's image. But every single person we meet is created in His image. And so when you hear their stories and you kind of hold space for them, you're adding dignity to their life and creating an opportunity for them to share in a really vulnerable, judgment-free zone, which is ministry.
That's right.
Right there. Ministry is happening.
Yeah, I've seen just amazing things happen. I've seen people walk out with just smiles on their faces that I hadn't seen the whole meeting up till then when they go through share time. And yeah, we do have those rules. We have five basic rules, and they're basically just anonymity is important. What's shared in the group stays in the group, and we're here to support each other, not fix each other. But one of the greatest things we say is we'd like to stick to 3 to 5 minutes if you can, and we don't want anyone interrupting anyone else. There's no crosstalk. There's no, the person is free to have their 3 to 5 minutes to themselves, and there's not going to be a conversation going on. And in fact, it feels a little cold sometimes because at the end of their share time, they'll share something that's very vulnerable and you just want to go give them a hug and you go, thank you. And you move to the next person and that's it.
Well,
and
this can happen in our anxiety, right? In our anxiety, we can want to fix someone.
Yeah, that's right.
But just in the same way that, you know, rule number one, step number one, I should say, is you have to admit you're powerless over this addiction, right?
Yeah,
and in the same way, if I'm powerless over this addiction, I'm also powerless over your addiction.
That's right.
Like I can't fix your addiction either. I can bear witness. I can be with you. We can be on this journey together, but I actually can't eliminate this addiction from your life.
That's absolutely right. Yeah. So share time was really full and rich. And then I started we have open meetings where it's kind of more a loose, kind of a general message, general things and some share time. And then we have what's called steps groups. And the steps groups are usually a 9 to 12 month group. and you go through four books and it becomes closed after the first book, but you really dive into the 12 steps and you actually write your spiritual inventory. You actually make your amends. You're held accountable by these people and you go through these steps. And by staying a year of sobriety and a steps group, you become qualified to become a sponsor. And so I went through a steps group before I ever led the meetings here. I led a small group here, but I was going through my steps group at a Lutheran church on the south end of town. And it was great. I met a bunch of great guys there that I'm still
friends with. Is that Redeemer, by the way?
Yeah, Redeemer.
Yeah, shout out to Lutheran Redeemer. They're doing some great work in our city as well.
That's right.
We mentioned Vineyard Church of the Rockies by name. Let's mention them by name.
Yeah, I mean, that first meeting I went to was Dayspring Church in Windsor off the I-25 and Windsor exit. That's where I went to my first Celebrate Recovery meeting, and I'm still friends with all of them. We trade testimonies. I go speak at their church. They come over to ours. So yeah, there's a community going on there that's cross-denominational and all that kind of stuff, which recovery is definitely a cross-denominational issue. Yep. And so yeah, I went to that steps group. I started digging in and started sharing things and started going through all of this stuff. And at the same time, I started the small group here. And then we started our open meetings about 6 years ago, I think, on Monday nights at 6:30 here.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. So yeah. those groups, if you're listening or you know someone who needs to come or you need to come yourself, those groups are currently being held at Vineyard Church of the Rockies at 6 o'clock or 6:30 p.m. Monday nights at Vineyard Church of the Rockies.
That's right.
But of course, you and I and many others, we have dreams about growing this ministry, this service to our city, and expanding that with Love Foco. And so there's a really, really, one of the reasons why I was so excited about this conversation on our podcast is because I wanted to let people know that when they support Love Foco, they're supporting guys like you, they're supporting services like you offer, Celebrate Recovery, creating really a community to invite people on a journey towards sanity.
That's right.
Not just sobriety.
That's right.
And seeing an impact in our lives and our communities in an incredible way. And so I know I'm really excited about what the opening of the Love Foco Resource Center could mean for even the expansion of Celebrate Recovery, the growth of your impact in our city. And we have big dreams. We have big dreams about what could come. And so, yeah, just share with us a little bit about some of the things that are on your mind, on your heart, not only to just continue Celebrate Recovery, but also see some of those other things grow.
Yeah, so our Celebrate Recovery has grown. We probably have 25 to 30 every Monday night. People come. We have probably 4 or 5 new people every week, it seems like. We have people coming from the halfway houses in the jail. I always say, you know, the Vineyard of the Rockies is right in the center of the jail, the homeless shelter, and the hospital. And yep. We're right in the middle. And we have Summit Stone and other mental health places all around us that send people our way. I dropped a guy off at the correctional facility last night that he was in the halfway house there that's started coming to our meetings. He had to be back by a certain time when we were running late. We had Thanksgiving dinner last night and stuff like that at our meeting. And so we have a lot of that going on. We also have several step studies groups. We have 3 of them going on right now at the same time. We have leaders leading those, and we just all kind of help each other. And so I'd say January or February, we're looking at having 15 new sponsors and new leaders into our group as they've gone through the STEP study program, along with just growth we've seen in our little band that we have that plays the songs before and different things like that. So all of that has just been amazing. And so we're probably about 45 people a week.
Yep.
And then a lot of other people, we also get to lead Celebrate Recovery at the Fort Collins Rescue Mission on Wednesday nights. Right now they had a fire. We have not been doing that for the last couple of months.
We interviewed Seth. We actually shared his episode just a little while ago. And so, yeah, he was able to talk about that. I know you're doing great work with them, but then also I envision an expansion of work as they open their new facility and, just going to continue to be able to walk in these recovery services, even in different spaces around the city.
That's right. It expands in all these different ways. Cause we had about 3 or 4 guys start going to the Sterling Correctional Facility, the largest prison in Colorado. Yeah. From our group.
Yep.
And the church, Vineyard of the Rockies, has supplied money over and over again for snacks and drinks and food and everything we need, and supplied the building that we meet in and done all these things to keep our group going. And those guys go to the Sterling Correctional Facility every 2 weeks. And I got to go there, sing some songs with the guys that are in prison, tell my testimony in 2 different sides of the prison. They're seeing things happen there. So there's all these opportunities to lead Celebrate Recovery at rehabilitation places and at the Fort Collins Rescue Mission and at the prison down there. There's a whole curriculum that's just designed for that. And so with the Love Foco Resource Center, our hopes are to grow even further into all of these things. Have a place where people can find out information. Where can I find a sponsor? Where can I find an accountability partner? Where can I find a meeting that's going on tonight? Is it here? Or is it at another church? Or how can we support the whole thing? Because really the goal is healing, not our own personal numbers. And then even down the road, the hopes are as maybe there's some space opening up in the Love Foco Resource Center, there's going to be people going to the other services, to Christ Clinic, to all these other things that have addiction in their own lives. One of the things that was amazing to me was I wasn't just helping this man come out of addiction. I was helping him regain his relationship with his children. I was helping him regain his marriage. I was helping him be a father. I wasn't helping him. I was providing this information, and he was taking the information and growing in it. And if you step into it, all of a sudden, down the road, this young man, this child might not know it, but they had a father in their life because they started coming to our group. And that all fits in really well with what Love Foco's goal is, from what I understand. And so we even have a dream in the future of offering the Celebrate Recovery has an entire youth curriculum called The Landing. And I don't know of any youth recovery in the entire city of Fort Collins. We have a dream of offering that as a meeting at some point down the road through the resources at Love Foco Resource Center and different things like that. And we're just allowing those things to happen. In the past, I pushed things to happen too fast in my life and things like that. We're breathing. We're growing at a really nice, healthy way. And we are dreaming of things that can come in the future.
Well, I don't know why there's any reason why that couldn't happen.
Yeah.
And of course, you and I, we see this the same way. Our hearts are aligned on this. The mental health crisis in the nation, but specifically in Northern Colorado, is crazy.
Yeah.
The drug use in the alcohol use is there. And I was addicted, pretty much high functioning addict from the age of 12 to 19. And I never even thought that there was a place where I could have received help. And of course, I had mentioned earlier, but lost my brother to a hard fight with mental health and addiction. And I wish so much in his teenage years, but also in his 20s and 30s after I got clean, he continued to struggle. I wish that in his community, there would have been a place like Celebrate Recovery to go to get a meal, to slow down, to be in community, to be surrounded with people who are trying to move towards health and healing. And he never had that. And so I'm so grateful and so thankful that we have something like that in our community and that there are a lot of people like you who are creating space and creating opportunity for people to do that. I want to ask you one final question.
Okay.
I'll ask the question, then I'm going to tell people about how they can support Celebrate Recovery and Love Foco so that we can build all the things that we're trying to build. That'll give you a minute to think. Okay. The question I want to ask you is, you know, what would you say to someone who's impacted by addiction, who's impacted by, you know, whether it's hidden or outright, and why they should come to your group on Monday nights at 6:30, just to give you an opportunity to send an invite out to whoever is listening to this, whether they're personally struggling with addiction or they know someone who is. Before you answer that, though, I do want to just say, if you're listening to this, please know that when you support Love Foco, that part of your resources go to propping up things like Celebrate Recovery, working in tandem with all the other nonprofits that will be under one roof at the Love Foco Resource Center. We're about to open. We're under construction right now. Until we're open, all of these services are being offered around different parts of the city and different buildings. And the Love Foco Resource Center will unify all of them together so that there can be a lot of that cross-pollination and cross-work that Brian had mentioned. And so thank you for your generosity. You can always learn more at lovefoco.com or reaching out to us, info@lovefoco.com as well. We'd love to have more conversations with you about how you can get involved loving our city one life at a time. But Brian, let me throw it back to you, then just kind of close us out here with an invite to anyone who may have been in the same place you were 6 years ago
that
could use a community like Celebrate Recovery in their life.
I would say, first of all, just logistically, we are changing our name from CR at VOTR to CR Foco. We ran into a lot of problems with the wording of that first one. So in January, when you're looking for us, you can look at crfoco.com or on your social media at crfoco. So I just want to say that you can find us at crfoco. You'll see it on our signs. You're going to see it all over town. We're going to put some stuff together for that. I would say this, though. If you're struggling and you don't know what to do, we say keep coming back for a reason. We say on chip night, whenever we give a chip out for the 3 month, 9 month, 6 month, whatever it is, everyone in the crowd chants, keep coming back. It works if you work it and you're worth it. And so what I would say is on that last part, if you haven't come to anything yet and you're struggling, you're worth it and you're not alone. We're here and we're struggling right alongside of you, and we've struggled with the same things you're struggling with. So A, you're not alone, and B, you're worth it. Your family's worth it. Your children are worth it. The people around you are worth it for you just to take a step and step into a community. And as you keep showing up, you're going to be surprised at how little of the work is on you. And you're going to be surprised at the fact that you just keep showing up and you keep growing into this thing. And when you look back 6 months down the road, you're not going to believe the amount of growth you've experienced.
Brian, thank you so much for the work that you do. Thank you that every Monday night, I know that there's a group meeting that is not just trying to slog it through, but a group that is truly celebrating the recovery process.
Yeah.
Health, healing, and wholeness offered, you know, one day at a time, one moment at a time. I'm so grateful for you. I'm so grateful for the work that you're doing. And I want to say that this has not just the opportunity, this already is making generational impact in our community. And so thank you for the work that you're doing. Thanks for listening. And we'll circle back around maybe when the landing is open.
There you
go.
And
you're not only doing CR for adults, but you're doing CR for youth and teens as well.
We'll
have another conversation when that happens.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks, Brian.
Thanks for listening to The Love Foco Show. If today's conversation inspired you, share it with a friend who loves Fort Collins as much as you do. Don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode, and leave us a review. It helps more people discover us. To learn more about Love Foco and find opportunities for loving our city one life at a time, visit lovefoco.com. For now, keep loving Fort Collins well.